We will begin the meeting. We don't have a quorum yet. We need one more member to appear before we can officially call the meeting to order. But I have to comment, this is the quietest room that I think I've been in for quite some time. That's good. I guess among educators, we understand discipline and quiet, and this is really impressive.
I see funeral.
So feel free to visit a little bit. We'd like to begin the presentation, I think, even though we don't have a quorum on hand. So we have plenty of time then to ask questions and so forth. So our agenda today will provide an overview from the Private College Council. And to do that today, Dr. David Laird is here. And again, we have a screen in back that will allow people to see the presentation. Dr. Laird, would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm David Laird, the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. I have with me today David Etzweiler from Medtronic, who is a member of our board, and I'll introduce him at greater length later in the presentation. And our colleague, Erica Teibel, is with us on the projector today and cueing me on things if I need that, which could happen. Over the years, it's always been a pleasure to appear before this committee and to discuss with you what we think are important policy issues before the committee and before the state. We're delighted to be here today. We appreciate the time that you've given us. We appreciate your interest in our presentation, and we appreciate the concern and interest that you've shown as we and many of our campus representatives who are with us today have been expressing in our conversations with you individually. With the time that we have available today, we want to try to accomplish three things. First, review a bit about the history of private colleges and the present day service to the state. Second, discuss some of the challenges and opportunities that we see in our immediate and longer range future. And finally, present our recommendations to you, which are designed to begin to address the challenges and opportunities so that our state can deliberately build the kind of society and economy we want and need, rather than be surprised by the future. In your packets are three pertinent items to the presentation. First, in the published documents on the left-hand side of the packet are the most recent issue of our fact card, which we issue annually, and the booklet that contains our legislative recommendations and the details that follow those. And then also in your packet are copies of the slides that we're going to see on the screen as we go through the packet. As always, Mr. Chairman, we'd be comfortable if people want to stop us for details or for additional background while we're talking. But we have left plenty of time in the schedule for discussion and questions afterwards. Higher education has always been a Minnesota priority. The aspiration for higher learning is, in fact, in our DNA, passed on to us by the people who founded and built our state. When European settlers crossed half a continent in the mid-19th century to establish this place as their home, they brought with them more than just their families and possessions. They came here intending to build a better life for themselves and their posterity.
Dr. Laird, if I can interrupt for just a moment. We do have a quorum now, so I'll officially call a meeting of the Higher Education Finance Committee to order. So you may proceed.
Intending to build a better life for themselves and their posterity, and they did indeed succeed. Had they had more formal relations with the Indian cultures who were already here, We think they would have found a very strong set of educational values among those cultures as well. Higher education has always been a part of that theme. Although these immigrants largely had not graduated from what we now know as high school, they clearly placed a strong value in education. One New York newspaper remarked in 1857 that it seemed like every new town and city founded in the West was plotted with plans for a university square. Indeed, between 1849 and 1858, your predecessors in the territorial legislature were persuaded by their constituents to charter no fewer than 30 private colleges, including universities in Lake Clinton, Cedar Valley, Fremont City, and Hobart. Of those 30, only two survive today: Hamline University, the first university founded in Minnesota, which moved from Red Wing to its current home in St. Paul, and St. John's University, located then and now in Collegeville. The other 15 institutional members of our council were founded after statehood, with their roots firmly in the 19th century settlement and development of the state. Private colleges were founded by people from a variety of religious and cultural backgrounds, and as a result, our institutions were not and are not monolithic. They have campus cultures that can be very different from each other, and they certainly have different levels of financial resources available to them for executing their mission. As a result, each approaches their version of service in a different way. Our state is better for their diversity, and the quality of these institutions is the envy of many other states. What our colleges and universities do in common is our comprehensive approach to teaching the liberal arts and sciences, the exploration of the human condition, a focus on the personal growth of men and women whom we educate, and the goal of preparing students not only for their next job, but for continuing service to humankind, both here and elsewhere. Private colleges and universities have always been a part of this state, and we hope always will be. Over the course of Minnesota's nearly 150 years, our institutions and our graduates have made numerous contributions to our state's cultural, civic, and economic life. While we are not state institutions, we hope that after more than a century of service, we have earned the right to be considered essential resources of the state. As our state has prospered, so too have our institutions. In fact, we believe there is a strong correlation between the success of our state and our ability to serve the state, its people, and its businesses. We hope you will see this belief reflected in our policy recommendations we again make this year. Let's look at our service. In terms of sheer educational production, private, nonprofit colleges and universities play an important role in our state's economy. Our institutions are located in urban, suburban, rural communities all over the state, with 40,000 people enrolled in undergraduate programs and another 14,000 in graduate programs. Three-quarters of our students are Minnesotans, and fully 85% are from the five-state upper Midwest region. You might also remember that if we count full-time equivalents of the students who are working with us, we employ about 26,000 employees annually, and our contribution to the economy, unfettered, without any multiplier, is over $1 billion. Collectively, our 17 institutions award one-third of all baccalaureate degrees in Minnesota. This includes almost half of all foreign language degrees, almost half of all nursing degrees, 40% of all baccalaureate degrees in math and biological and physical sciences, 35% of all business degrees, 24% of computer and information science degrees, and 19% of all education degrees. We are active in master's level education as well, producing over 35% of all master's degrees, including almost half of all graduate level nursing degrees. Additionally, 30% of all bachelor's degrees and 27% of all master's degrees earned by people of color in Minnesota are awarded by our private colleges. By way of comparison, this is a much greater percentage than the state university. Our production has an incredible return on investment for the state of Minnesota. Through financial aid programs that cost the state less than $40 million per year, our institutions produce one-third of all baccalaureate degrees. To produce the other two-thirds at public institutions, the state spends somewhere in the order of $500 million on tuition subsidies and other financial aid, which doesn't take into account the direct capital subsidies that the state spends for buildings and equipment on the public campuses. We say this simply to illustrate the incredible deal that the state's taxpayers are getting from its private colleges. Our colleges are primarily traditional residential four-year institutions. But please remember, seven of our colleges and universities offer non-traditional weekend and evening programs, and two of our colleges offer two-year programs. While no one can dispute the University of Minnesota's role in this state's research as this state's research university, our students and faculty are currently working on over 60 research projects supported by nearly $23 million in funding from federal grants and contracts. Some of those are going to be on display this Thursday in the rotunda of the Capitol. Six of our institutions operate one of the federally funded TRIO programs, which help low-income, first-generation students in junior high school, and college to get on and stay on a successful college track. More than 2,900 qualifying students are served by those institutions. Service to society is indeed the central purpose of our institutions, and it's ingrained in the work we do. Our students, faculty, staff, and alumni perform many thousands of hours of volunteer community service each year in a wide variety of educational and human service functions throughout the state. Who are our students? Private college students come from a diverse background. 10% of our students are people of color, and 1,500 international students have found their way to Minnesota by attending a private college. This is a long-standing commitment and tradition of our colleges. 62% of our undergraduate students graduate within 4 years, and 72% graduate within 6 years. Perhaps the biggest misconception about private colleges is that only wealthy students can afford to attend our institutions. Not so. The last data survey of college students, the 1999 high school follow-up survey, showed that private colleges enroll a student body that is roughly the same median income as that of the state universities, and actually a lower median income than that of the University of Minnesota's student body. The highest median family income students are those who left the state for their education and receive financial aid through reciprocity agreements with our surrounding states. Although we have a tuition sticker price that is roughly five times higher than that of state universities and three times higher than that of the University of Minnesota, a commitment on the part of our institutions for financial aid makes a private college education affordable for all. Over 90% of our undergraduate students receive financial aid from our institutions, with the average award just under $6,000. Our collective financial aid is pretty close to $200 million. Our Pell aid is about 20, and we receive just under 40 of the state grant program. So our institutional commitment is roughly three times what our students receive collectively from both federal and state government. If you think about it, we enroll over 40,000 undergraduate students each year. On average, tuition and fees, room and board charges for this year was $26,092. There are very few families in the upper Midwest who can afford to pay that much per year out of their own resources. Our financial aid policies and our students' and families' willingness to pay the primary reason we're able to enroll the student body we have and to operate as we do. If you go back and read the histories of these colleges, that kind of support for students and their family began the first year of operation for all of these institutions. This is a tradition, not something that's new. As you might suspect, tuition is far and away the biggest source of revenue for our institution. Over 60% of our institution's operating funding comes from tuition. Some of our members are as high as 85% in terms of the source of revenue. Much is made of the private college endowments, but we want to dissuade you today from the notion that private colleges are sitting on sizable endowments that somehow make them immune from economic and market forces. In the calculation for the slide which is appearing now, we have used the median value of the endowments held by 15 of the 17 institutions in our association. We've not included Carleton or McAllister College in this comparison because they are outliers. They are blessed to have very sizable endowments. Yet, we should add, even together they're not as big as the universities. They have used their financial clout to become internationally elite liberal arts colleges, comparing favorably in national performance rankings to institutions like Wesleyan, Bowdoin, Williams, and Swarthmore. They are treasures of this state. For the rest of our institutions, examining the current value of our endowments, assuming an industry standard rate of return on investments and an industry standard annual expenditure rate, you can see an aggregated estimate of these institutions' endowment spending. Dividing that number by the number of students we educate each year, you can see that our endowment spending per student is modest, but doesn't make us immune from the ups and downs of the economy. In fact, our average is significantly less than what the state provides public colleges for students they educate, which is somewhere in the range of $4,000 to $6,000, depending on the institutional type. Our reliance on tuition revenue derived from our students and families is the primary reason why our tuition price is higher than that of public institutions. Another important source of revenue for our institutions is the financial aid that students earn to help pay their tuition bill. This money comes from both private and public sources. The slide you're now seeing shows that the amount of private financial aid and Cal State grant awards that our students earn and are using to pay for their attendance. For our 40,000 undergraduates, 6,800 receive private financial aid. Examples of this aid could be scholarships from the local VFW, local businesses and chambers, the parents' labor union, or the businesses for whom they might work. It also includes scholarships given by benefactors with special requirements for our institutions to follow. This aid is earned by students both on the basis of need as well as merit. Of our undergraduate students, about 22% receive Pell Awards, averaging $2,345 per student, and just over 10,000 students, about one in four of our undergraduates, received help through the state grant program for their attendance. So these are both very good measures for you to think about when you're trying to determine whether we're providing service to low-income people in the state and middle-income people. 22% of our undergraduates are on Pell, which is a program targeted to only the lowest income students, and about 25% of our undergraduates are on state grants, which are on a variable curve. You can see that their average state grant award was just under $3,100 per student. This is significantly less than what the state would have had to pay for the education of these students had they chosen a public college or university in Minnesota. But please don't assume that had they not attended our institutions, that they necessarily would have stayed in the state and attended a local institution. We know from their applications that in many cases they would have likely gone to private or public universities elsewhere in the country had they not stayed here. We believe that through private gift aid, federal and state grants and loans, institutionally provided financial aid, and our students' and families' own resources and hard work, private colleges can be and are presently affordable for nearly all. To be sure, a private college education is expensive, but not unaffordable. And all of these sources of support are necessary and needed for our students to be able to attend college. Now let's look at some of our challenges. I want to focus on two at the beginning here. A shortage of educated people is right on our horizon, and the growing importance of research to our regional economy is with us always. We consider you to be the state's investment committee for human capital, and as such, you need to be sure that we meet these challenges with the help of all of us. We've talked with many of you about the coming shortage of high school graduates. Between 2003 and 2013, projecting current K-12 and higher education performance into the future, there will be a 10% decline in high school graduates who are available to go to college. Let's stop and emphasize. This is if we continue our current patterns. This is like the marketing team talking to management and saying, if we continue along the lines we're on, this is what's going to happen, but let's change that picture. And we're here to say, and David's going to emphasize, we're here to say we'll be partners in changing that picture. We need a lot more partners, though, if we're going to succeed. Even more significant than the high school graduates, though, is that within the high school graduating cohorts, we will see an even steeper decline of white graduates and a great increase in the number of people of color graduating from high school. The decline in the white population can be traced to changes in birth rates for about 20 years that have continued unabated. The increase in the number of people of color who are going to be graduating from our high schools is maybe the best news in this whole story, and we shouldn't lose sight of it for its potential and its example to others. The reason that this is so significant to us in higher education and to those who would like to employ our graduates is that the decline will occur in populations that are now more likely to go to college, while the increase will be in populations that in the past have not been as likely to enter or succeed in college. We can and should change them. On our present course, the people who will be available to enter some level of post-secondary education are likely to be less academically prepared and less financially prepared than we're accustomed to seeing in higher education. The result will be a significant decline in entering freshmen and in bachelor's degrees awarded 4 years later, unless we change our behavior. And I might recall for those of you who were here the last time we reported to you, in a survey we did of 2002 graduates of our colleges, we found a very, very significant transformation among lower income students attending our colleges and graduating 4 years later. 4 years later, entering the job market, entering graduate school, surveying their attitudes, surveying their incomes, surveying their judgment about the investment that they had made in higher education, they look just like their highest income peers. We dared you then, and we still dare you to find another item in the state's budget where you could find that kind of transformation in 4 years with the level of investment that you're now making. Back to the shortfall. To this shortfall in production overlay the rapid increase in the number of retirees leaving the workforce. Also, according to Deed, many of the new jobs that they project will be created over this period, the decade, will require increasing levels of education as new technologies create new business opportunities for the businesses that have access to trained people. The next slide reflects the difference between the projected supply and demand for baccalaureate degree holding members of the workforce. Changing these projections will require strategic policy direction and consistent investments for at least the next decade. Anyone who wishes to start or grow a business here in Minnesota in the next years ahead will have to deal with a very competitive market for labor. As the late 90s saw competition for all kinds of labor, these projections would indicate that those days will be with us soon in force. And indeed, the Federal Reserve Bank is already predicting that that we're going to have a structured labor force deficit in the very near future, before our economy gets back to what we would all call equilibrium. When it comes to the importance of research and educated labor, we don't think the case for having a world-class research university in our backyard can be made any better than that quote from Alan Greenspan, which is appearing on the slide now. Our nation's economy and our regional economy will depend on the ability of higher education to generate scientific and technological breakthroughs. In Minnesota, that points primarily to the University of Minnesota. The competition for excellence in research, especially in areas involving high technology, is fierce. The U of M's competitors are not only in Madison or Boston or North Carolina or California. Foreign countries are using their newfound wealth and the people we've educated to make significant strides forward. In the last year, Korea lured away a California Research Institute Nobel Prize winner to run one of their top research institutions. And parenthetically, it was just last spring that the Koreans discovered the most significant breakthrough in DNA research in the world. Europeans and Asians are making advances in biotechnology almost monthly. Ask our businessmen who are competing worldwide. California voters approved a multi-billion-dollar statewide referendum to increase investments for biotechnology research. Wisconsin's governor has just proposed spending several millions of dollars to improve the University of Wisconsin's research capacity. On a personal note, I've been traveling to People's Republic of China on a regular basis for the last 20 years to meet and confer and consult with the higher education leaders of that nation. I can tell you that in the past 5 years, that nation has made higher education a top investment priority, using the profits from their substantial economic gains to dramatically improve their higher education institutions. Last year, they graduated 10 times as many engineers as we did in the United States. Even adjusting for scale, that's pretty impressive. And on top of all of this increase in competition, our federal government is making it harder for American colleges and universities to bring talented foreign students and faculty members here. In the aftermath of 9/11, new State Department regulations have significantly reduced foreign student immigration, and many of our competitor nations are gaining from that.
Sure.
Representative Carlson.
If I could ask a question, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Laird put that offer out there. And I asked a question of Dr. Brunix the other day. I had a chance to engage in a conversation with representatives of Taiwan. And they have a long history of sending students to the United States, Minnesota in particular. Now, I know the U of M has drawn a lot of them. I don't know how many have come to our private colleges. I do know some have, because I met one individual that had attended one of our private colleges. I forget which one. But they made the point about tuition and the U.S. dollar and the fact that students in Taiwan are choosing places like New Zealand, Australia, because they do like to go to English-speaking countries, Canada, and even Great Britain over the United States rather than the United States because of the cost of attendance here and the shifting value of the dollar. And I'm just curious if that's been a part of any conversations you've had with the private college council or your presidents, if that's having an impact on your ability to attract foreign students generally, or in this case, they were talking about their needs, you know, Taiwan.
Chairman, Representative Carlson, yes, that has been a factor. That factor is now being overwhelmed by the problems those people are having getting visas to come here. And indeed, in some of the Asian nations, the growing middle class and their robust savings rates have made affordability much less a question for them than it has been in the past. It's not uncommon at all to have families say, we can meet the price. You just have to figure out a way to get us in here so that we can study. And our competitor nations have figured out that, that we're at a disadvantage. So they are heavily recruiting those students, and in some cases are offering additional financial inducements. The European Union has a $200 million five-year commitment on the table for students and faculty, and they're being very generous in their awards. And all up and down the Asian coastline, the nations there are especially being accommodating to Chinese students from the mainland, not just Taiwan.
Thank you.
Yeah. Dr. Laird, you can continue.
Thank you, Chairman. The competition that I was referring to and the policies underlying our current difficulties are hastening Asia's investment in their own educational institutions and causing them to create new student enrollment agreements with institutions, as I just said, in Europe and throughout the Asian Crescent. There are a couple of proposals before Congress to reform and enhance student immigration practices, including one that our own Senator Coleman has offered. We hope that the Congress will look at that on a bipartisan basis and see a way to do something like that, or if there are competing proposals, to consider those as well. And what if we do nothing? What will happen? Other audiences to whom we presented this information have asked us to think about how markets and institutions might respond to these changing times. And generally, their questions have to do with incumbent workers entering higher education, retirees working past the standard retirement age, the ability of colleges to import more students, and the ability of businesses to import the educated people they need. First, we think that the evidence shows that adults in the workforce over age 25 are not likely to flock to higher education in response to a shortage of educated workers. On the contrary, they go to college when there's a shortage of jobs. And go all the way back to the Depression and see that that relationship carrying forward. In Minnesota, adults entering college and unemployment rates are clearly inversely linked. State policies should encourage more people to obtain more higher education, but we shouldn't rely on adult workers to make up for the educated people gap by themselves. Will retirees work longer than age 65? Probably some of us will. But if the economy improves and 401k values go up, there may actually be some increased early retirements. While the baby boomer generation will work longer, the folks that businesses will look to build the businesses of the future will likely be younger than I. Can we import more college students? Not from surrounding states. Almost all of them are going to be in worse shape than we are. And it's too expensive to bring students from the far reaches of the country, educate them, and hope they stay, and make our investment in them worthwhile. Also, it would be poor policy and even worse economics to spend public dollars to bring wealthy, high-achieving citizens from other states who may not stay here while ignoring the opportunities for our own people. So we import labor that worked in the 90s during the very rapid business expansion here. There was a lot of that, and we all benefited. Many of the people who came are middle-income people with children. But the business people we talk to and those who serve on our board say that under today's conditions, it's not likely, too expensive, and the competition for those people is now worldwide, not just regional, not just state by state. We believe that if all sectors of Minnesota higher education don't produce more college graduates in the short and long term than we're projected to, then there will be profound economic impacts. The shortage of educated people will affect businesses in a way they won't tolerate. They will, by necessity, choose to grow elsewhere. They will expand elsewhere. And there is a risk that at some point they will pick up and move their businesses to where the educated people are, to where the top research institutions are located, and to where the growing markets will be, the southern and western United States and Asia. Now let's turn to our agenda for 2005. We believe that the best way to build a better future for Minnesota than these projections would suggest is we'll have to target our energies and resources in higher education toward three goals. First, prepare more people for post-secondary education. We have to develop a different partnership with K-12, and we have to look together at how we're going to achieve better performance, more successes, better transitions. Ensure affordable access to all types of post-secondary learning. It's not an either-or. It's not a public-private. This is not a training versus higher education. This is all of us. We need more educated people at every level. And third, we need to provide the University of Minnesota with the research facilities and talents that it needs to ensure our state's businesses can compete in the world economy of the future. To this end, we have a four-part legislative recommendation for this biennium. Expand and replicate TRIO programs. Increase the number and size of state grant awards. Restore the maximum post-secondary child care grant to $2,600 per year and ensure excellence in the research-related functions of the University of Minnesota. On the TRIO, parents who have been to college and are more likely to have children who also go to college. This is a very strong link, it's nationwide, and present for a long time. Parents who don't have post-secondary background are more likely to have children who don't go to college or who don't succeed. Because our economy for the future will depend so heavily on the educational attainment of people who will be the first in their families to go to college, we think our state needs to improve its efforts to get inside these students' decision-making loop while they're still in junior high and high school and get them on a college track. College track requires students to be 4A's, aware of the importance of college, aspire to attend college, achieve good grades in a rigorous curriculum, afford college, and attain a degree in a timely fashion. Rather than have the state build all new initiatives to serve these students, we propose using state money to replicate and expand two programs within the TRIO suite of programs. TRIO, as you might recall, refers to seven different programs that are funded by the federal government under the Higher Education Act. Together, they are designed to increase the high school graduation and post-secondary success rate of students from low-income, first-generation backgrounds. And they have been extremely successful in 30-plus years of existence. In Minnesota, 30 colleges and universities and one Indian tribe have won competitive grants from the Department of Education to operate one or more of seven different TRIO programs. These 31 grantees include six private colleges, the two University of Minnesota campuses in Duluth and Twin Cities, the Leech Lake Tribal Council College, the Chippewa Tribe, and 21 Minuscule Institutions. We propose that the state add $10 million to expand and replicate the Talent Search and Upward Bound programs of TRIO, which are expressly focused on junior high and high school populations. National statistics indicate that the post-secondary matriculation rates for low-income first-generation students who are not in Upward Bound is 33%. Last year, Minnesota's Upward Bound programs had a college matriculation rate of 70%. By replicating and expanding an existing program, we can take advantage of federal training resources and leverage that to our direct benefit. We estimate that the $10 million for the biennium will serve approximately 4,500 more students per year. As I said, these two programs have a long and distinguished record, and so the state will know it is getting a quality program with demonstrated results without the typical startup and administrative costs. State grant program. To make college more affordable for both low and middle income students at all of the state's higher education institutions, we propose expanding the state grant program. This is our top priority for the 2005 legislative session, as it has been for nearly 30 years. Given the population of students that will be available to enter higher education in the years ahead, affordability will be an ever-increasing barrier. College financial aid programs should be looked at not simply as the way in which we help the poor go to college, but as a way this state can meet its strategic interest in assuring a population of educated people. That's an investment strategy. Minnesota has one of the best need-based financial aid programs in the country, both in terms of its program design and the level of benefits that students can receive. In the Measuring Up 2004 report issued by the National Center for Public Policy in Higher Education, Minnesota received the third highest grade in the country for accessibility. Unfortunately, in a year in which states cut higher education spending almost uniformly, we received a C-minus grade. But no state received better than a B, and most states received failing grades in part because of their weaker commitment to need-based aid. Our state grant program is operated under the principle of design for shared responsibility. Our state financial aid system insists that students, parents, federal and state taxpayers all have an abiding interest and a role in helping students attend the college or program that best meets their needs. Students have the largest role, but taxpayers step in to help with aid that is appropriate and proportionate to a family's ability to pay. Because there is a cap on the amount of a student's actual tuition charge that is counted under the program, the model also assumes a strong role for private college institutional aid. In Minnesota, the state of the Pell and state grant programs are coordinated to provide benefits to both low and middle income students at all qualifying institutions of higher learning in Minnesota. This slide indicates the combined level of federal and state financial aid that is available for students at a variety of income levels and attending a variety of institutions. The federal and state aid available is expressed here as a percentage of the posted tuition charge that a student at one of those institutions is asked to pay. As you can see, the program provides significant help to students at all qualifying institutions. Presently, we're doing pretty well for low-income students, and we're providing some benefits to middle-income students, those who are often most squeezed by the rising tuition prices and a lack of financial aid. An increased investment on the part of the state would help students at all levels of income, particularly as their characteristics and demographics are changing. Specifically, we suggest that the state increase investment in the state grant program by adjusting four of the policy dials that are available to you. First, we recommend lowering the student share from 46 to 45%. You might recall it started out at 50%, and some years ago you moved it down to 46. We think looking ahead to the changing demographics, it's prudent to begin moving it down first. Second, increase the four-year college tuition and fees cap, which applies to students in all sectors, by 5.5% per year for each of the next 2 years. Third, we urge that you allow student eligibility for financial aid for a fifth year of college attendance. We have that in place. It was taken off the table 2 years ago because of the budget squeeze. We recommend that it's time to take another look at that. And fourth, also associated with a cut that was made 2 years ago, restore the living and miscellaneous expense allowance to its previous level of 54.5. Together, we estimate that these policy choices will cost the state $45 million in this biennium, and it's a good investment. The student share reduction would benefit students in all institutions, proportionate to the amount of tuition that a student is asked to pay. Essentially, we are recommending that students shoulder 1 percentage point less of their college costs while asking the parents and taxpayers to shoulder 1% more. Because the University of Minnesota and the private colleges have the highest recognized tuitions in the program, our students would receive a greater level of benefit increase at the outset. The second point in our state grant recommendation would increase the amount of tuition charged by four-year institutions that is counted under the state grant program by increasing the cap by 5.5% in each of the next 2 years. This policy change would have the state recognize more of the cost that our students pay for their education. If you can see from the slide that's before you, the average state grant that is earned by the 25% of our students who qualify on the basis of their financial need covers only 12% of what our institution's average comprehensive fees are. Since 1997, the average state grant earned by our students has changed very little, while by necessity, our tuitions have risen each year. Between 1997 and 2004, we have 202 fewer state grant recipients. The average state grant they have earned has risen by $148, while our comprehensive tuition and fee charges have risen by an average of $7,500. We are doing the best we can to remain affordable for these students, but we hope that the state will do its part in our partnership to educate the future leaders of the state. Many compare what the state provides private college students through the state grant program with what is provided for private college or for public college students through the same program. These analyses generally ignore the financial aid of low tuition made possible through state operating subsidies at the public institutions. We wish the analyses of support for students would include all forms of state support, not just direct state grant aid. In looking just at the state grant support generously provided to our students by the legislature, we don't think there's any way to reasonably conclude that our students are over-subsidized. Only 1 in 4 of our students receive a state grant. The other 3 in 4 receive no grant aid from the state, nor do our institutions. And for those who do qualify, the average award is an exceptionally modest $3,054. We cannot educate a student at our institutions for $3,054 a year. Neither can our public counterparts. We receive from the state between $4,000 and $6,000 for each student they enroll, regardless of their student's actual ability to pay. And because our state grant students are qualifying for financial aid due only to their financial situation, there is a limit as to how much we can ask them to pay.
I can interrupt for just a moment. We have a question from Representative Carlson.
Sure. Again, taking the invitation of Dr. Laird, I'm looking at the chart that you have up there, and what would that picture look like if we included the Pell Grant? I mean, what's the history during that same period then of Pell Grant being that the state grant by design, and you and I worked on the original design, is a backfill? I'm suspicious that might change some of those numbers if we were to include the Pell but I'd appreciate your commenting on that.
Sure. There would be an increase in the averages and in the actual amounts. The PAL has increased slightly during that period, to the extent that our students qualify for those, our students have benefited from that PAL increase. So there would be an underlying increase there. In some cases, there would be an equal reduction in the amount of the state grant that they might have received, all other conditions being equal.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, if your number crunchers could, using this chart as a base, include the Pell so that we could kind of see how that is interacting, that might be done.
Chairman, Representative Carlson.
Dr. Laird.
We'll certainly give it a try.
Thank you.
Final point on the state grant recommendation that I was referring to. We should make clear here that we're not asking for parity with public institutions in the level of public support provided to our students. We have been leading advocates of retaining the private college cap in the state grant program. We think it makes abundant policy, good policy, and we have felt that it has protected you and us from criticisms that would be made if it weren't present. And we also believe very firmly that the state should not be offering any incentives for our institutions to be raising their tuitions. So we're comfortable with the policy and the framework of the cap. All we're asking for here is an adjustment to reflect the increases in the past. Footnote here, another reason to consider the four-year tuition cap this year is because the University of Minnesota's tuition price is inching up toward the current cap. State funding provided by the legislature does indeed have some relationship to tuition prices charged by the public institution. And as a result, there's a great deal of interplay between state operating subsidies, tuition charges, and the financial aid needs of public college students. At present, the average U of M tuition and fees price is about 8.5% below the state grant program's four-year cap. It seems likely that if the U of M tuition isn't over the current cap in the first year of the next biennium, certainly will be in the second year. This makes the cap an issue that affects not only our low and middle income students, but also qualifying students at the U of M as well. Our third request under the state grant recommendation would restore eligibility for financial aid by making the fifth year of attendance again eligible for financial aid. Increasingly, baccalaureate programs are taking longer to complete because of degree requirements for students who attend part-time or for those who return to college from the workforce. Also, for any baccalaureate program with a practicum, such as teaching and nursing, or for programs that have more course requirements, such as engineering, architecture, physical therapy, and at your request, accounting, it's difficult to finish in just 4 years, even with full-time attendance. And while we want to encourage students to buckle down and complete in a timely fashion, we ought to recognize that for some students, they will simply have to take longer to finish their degrees. If we don't, we risk forcing students to pick programs of study based on whether they can afford those programs rather than their personal academic interests or aspirations. Our fourth recommendation under the state grant program is to restore the living and miscellaneous expense to its previous level of 5405. This is an across-the-board aid cut that was enacted for this biennium as a way to make the program affordable within the level of state support that was available for the biennium. Increasing this allowance will help students at all of the state's colleges and universities.
Dr. Laird, again, we have a question from Representative Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Laird, I'm interested in your response to what I perceive to be at least one more reason why the fifth year of attendance should be covered, which is that at least for a substantial portion, I would think, of incoming college students, they're not entirely sure what degree they want to get, what field they want to focus on. And there's some advantage, certainly in the context of a liberal arts education, to having an opportunity to sample a variety of different areas and maybe even start heading down one path and deciding it's not the path that they want to spend their life on from an educational background. And certainly what degree, what field they get the degree in is going to affect what they do for the next 40 or 50 years work. And we want them to have the opportunity for their own personal aspirations and as well as for our own economy to be able to change paths and not be hampered by that lack of eligibility, not be forced into a channel that they've chosen perhaps mistakenly in the first place. What's your reaction to that?
Dr. Laird,
do you see it happening?
I suspect you're describing people that many of us know real well. Yes, indeed. We need to have some flexibility. But our institutions and our students need to recognize that resources are not unlimited either. So I think what we would advocate is that we be careful and we maintain some tension so that students who can and should finish on time do in greater numbers than they do presently, and that we have resources available and eligible for students like the ones you're describing, or students who, because of their previous preparation, are not well suited to finish everything on time. And we need to be sure that that we make successes out of them, or at least offer them the opportunity to become successes, and that will require some financial aid resources to do so. We think that we can find that balance together if we're conscious of the different groups that need to be served, and that we maintain some incentive for the institutions to get as many completers on time as we can.
Representative Lacks.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Laird, sounds like from your presentation that you are in fact suggesting that we might redefine what on time means as well. If changing degree requirements and practicums are actually changing the length of time that ought to be expected to take to get a baccalaureate degree, then maybe on time no longer means a bright line at 4 years. But on time really does mean 4.5 years or 5 years, even for people who come to college fully prepared academically.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Laird. Representative Lacks, that'd be a useful discussion. It ought to be out in the open. I don't think there are simple answers to that, particularly not if we look at the changing demographic characteristics of the students we're going to have for the future, and particularly if we understand the imperative for all of us, the mutual self-interest in creating more successes of them. But I'm sure others would say, and I have to remember, we're working within a set of constrained resources, and higher education is not our highest priority. But we would certainly encourage you and your colleagues to consider inducing that conversation. And we might all learn a good bit from it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, on that note, and Dr. Laird, can you make a tie-in between the first proposal, which has to do with the TRIO programs and college access activities, in terms of what kind of impact that could have on this issue of remedial education in post-secondary? Because that's part of this discussion, is if you're remediating for the first year or two, then it begs the question about what on time would be for a particular student. And I suspect that there probably is a tie between those TRIO type activities and the ability of students with that particular experience to enter post-secondary, perhaps necessitating less remedial type of activities.
Dr. Laird.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, indeed the evidence suggests a very strong correlation. one of the strengths of the TRIO programs over the years has been their collection of data and their understanding of the need to show that they're making a difference and to remind each other of how important that is. My understanding that over the life of those programs, the matriculation rates, the retention rates, the graduation rates for graduates of the TRIO programs have exceeded the general rates for the general population in all of those categories over the lifetime of those programs. That's the good news. The unfortunate news is that those programs, both nationally and in Minnesota, are still only serving 10% of the eligible population. So there's a lot more to go. And for many of the students that we were referring to with Representative West, you could make a significant impact on their ability to matriculate and succeed at the college level with a pretty modest investment in their preparation for and transition. And then some of them do require some additional assistance while they're matriculated in college, and the programs have a pretty good record of succeeding with those students as well.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mariani?
I'm just wondering, and I haven't had a chance to speak with you personally yet, but it might be a good investment of the committee's time in the coming weeks to carve out some time to explore this issue of the TRIO and TRIO-type programs in the state and what relationship our possible increased investment in them could have to some of these bigger outcomes in post-secondary. And, as you know, Mr. Chair, I spent part of my time when I'm not in the legislature working on a number of issues related to this, and I would certainly work to get the right kind of folks here to have a meaningful discussion. I suspect that the private college council and the university and ministry can also do that as well.
Good suggestion. We'll continue to talk. Representative Carlson.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, a question about remedial that's been put on the table. There is a school of thought that one of the driving forces with remedial, and I'm asking this question much broader than private colleges because I don't know how much remedial work your campuses do, that the college entrance tests are not well aligned with the high school curriculums that are taught. And the question is, what kind of work is being done to make sure that those tests reflect what's being taught in the high schools, and that, I guess, inherent in that question is thereby reducing the need for remedial work? Do we have a disconnect between the colleges and their entrance exams and the high school curriculums?
Dr. Laird.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I understand your question. I think it's much easier to say that we do have a disconnect between the preparation students are getting in high school and what should be expected of them for college work. It's a little bit more difficult to tie in the standardized tests. But do remember that over the past 10 or 15 years, the higher quality institutions in the country have started to rely much less on the results of the college tests as a predictor of college success. They looked more intensely at the courses students have taken, the performance of students measured against their peers, and the ways in which students are involved in leadership, community, and other kinds of activities that are good predictors of their perseverance and their commitments. The college-bound tests have been undergoing significant changes in the past few years. The most significant is being implemented now this year by introducing writing exams for students who are taking the SATs. That is an indication that the colleges are saying to the testers, we need to have a better idea of how well students can express themselves in writing. And in this particular exam, they're being tested on how well they can write in a short period of time without the opportunity to go back and revise or to work with others on their work.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to say, I think college entrance is one question. Inherent in the question, if they've made it in and then they're taking remedial courses, is kind of the center of my question, is what's determining the need for the remedial courses? And I understand your point that some students haven't necessarily taken the college track, if you will. But there are others that need to hear this mainly out of the K-12 community, that the college tests aren't very well aligned with our curriculum, and that's kind of the core of my question. And I, maybe it's a chicken and the egg kind of thing, but my question is, what kind of work and dialogue is going on? I did read the other day where the college entrance exams are being changed, like with the writing test, and in fact it's going to be a much longer exam, I guess. Maybe that's part of the realignment, I don't know, but there is that you hear more out of the K-12 community than you do out of the higher ed community in terms of how well things are aligned.
Dr. Laird.
Chairman, Representative Carlson, let me start by answering one of your earlier questions. We do more remedial work than we feel we ought to with the students that we enroll. We don't isolate it and call it that. And I think it's fair to say that the greatest differences in preparation for college-level work are in math and sciences. And there are huge differences in the preparation that students receive from different schools. So an institution that's paying attention carefully to each applicant literally has to have a book on almost every school that those students apply from, so that they can gauge what kind of work those students have done, what kind of depth that they've had in math and sciences based upon previous students that have either applied or matriculated at that institution. And then with both faculty and with student peer help, we try to bridge those differences just as quickly as we can without stigmatizing those students being in a separate track or being in a remedial program or that sort of thing. And I think it's fair to say that our institution, some of our institutions have tremendous track records for turning those challenges into successes.
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought I almost heard it sound like Representative Carlson was asking if the college curriculum should be geared to K-12 on what the students are coming out with, and I don't think he was probably asking that, but the tests that the college students are still taking now, it's your impression that they are going to be indicative of their ability to succeed in college. I'm assuming that's the case, but that there is the TRIO program, and some of these are dealing with the schools that are, for whatever reason, are not preparing the students with the background to maybe be as successful in college. But I don't know if there's a, I guess my question is there a disconnect in the test to predict success for students that are coming into college without remedial work when they get in college? It's true or not.
Dr. Laird.
Chairman, Representative Cox, I think we're delving into a technical area about the test that I don't feel comfortable responding to. I go back to what I said to Representative Carlson. Many institutions have decided that the results of the tests are less good predictors of college success than other measures. It doesn't mean they're throwing them away, but many of the colleges are making them optional for students. And many of the colleges are relying less on those tests as a predictor. Nevertheless, I wouldn't walk out of here and shout to our students that they don't have to worry about taking the college prep test. They're still going to be one of the steps that you walk through in order to signal your interest and your willingness and indeed your ability to consider doing college work.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Just very quickly, it's my understanding that some schools will use the, up here of course it's mostly the ACT, but will use the ACT test as a placement indicator for their incoming students. So they'll use it as an assessment. So in addition to just admissions, there's also some kind of an assessment element that these tests are being used by some colleges in terms of placing students at an appropriate level of coursework.
Dr. Laird, you may continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to do some editing here and move forward quickly. One other comment about the state grant situation. As you consider changes to our state grant program, you should remember that the federal government has not done us any favors this year. Next year, a change in the federal needs assessment will mean that many thousands of Minnesota students will see cuts in their Pell Grant award. And because Minnesota also uses the same needs analysis calculation, many students' state grant awards are scheduled to be cut as well. Doesn't mean their needs gone away. This means the federal government has redefined it. And we would ask you and your staff to join us in taking a good look at how we can ameliorate some of those effects without disrupting the basic integrity of the program. As the population of Minnesota's available college students change in the next 5 to 10 years, student financial aid will be an even more strategic interest of the state. It will be a critical component in the ability of the state's higher education enterprise to provide enough educated people to maintain a healthy, growing economy and a viable community. I'm not going to go into detail about our child care grant, except to say that I think all members who participated in the reduction in the maximum 2 years ago regretted doing that, but felt that it was important to do that in order to offer child care grants to a broader group of the applicants that were in line. What we're recommending is that we reach out and increase that maximum to its previous level, and make sure that we're not reducing the number of students served in the same process. A number of members of the committee have expressed some interest in that, and we found similar concerns in the Senate. Let me turn to our final recommendation and try to do this quickly, Mr. Chairman. I want to be sure we hear from my colleague here. Our final recommendation involves our belief in the importance of scientific research for Minnesota's future economy. We believe it is in the interest of our state and ultimately our private colleges for Minnesota to attract high-tech, future-focused businesses that offer our people exciting careers, doing important work, and offering higher wages. To foster this kind of business community, we simply must have a world-class research institution in our state, and that institution must be the University of Minnesota. Competition for the best faculty and graduate students is not regional or even national. It is worldwide. For the university to compete and win, it must have the ability and resources to undertake. The recommendation does not have a suggested level of financial support. Ultimately, the university, the legislature, and the governor must review the university's plans and proposals, capabilities, and their own priorities and suggestions, and decide what support is appropriate. We simply want to state how important it is to the future of the state that the university's request in this area be taken very seriously. When it comes to research in the sciences, the U of M is our university too. Our faculty and students benefit from the learning and cooperative opportunities that come when you have a large public research university in your own backyard. And the university depends on us, too. Private liberal arts colleges in the state produce nearly half of the math, science, and nursing and health-related baccalaureate degrees that are awarded in the state each year. And many of our graduates choose to continue their education at the university's graduate schools. our role as the most significant provider of baccalaureate graduates in the basic and applied sciences is important as the university strives to give our state's businesses a home field advantage in the economy of the future. Chairman, these recommendations are made by our board of directors. There's a list of them on the back of our legislative recommendation brochure. I'm pleased to have one of their leaders, David Etzweiler, an executive at Medtronic and the chairman of our board's public policy committee, with us to offer closing comments and to enter into the discussion that we may have after our comments.
Welcome to the committee, and if you would identify yourself for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm David Etzweiler. I'm the Senior Director of Government Affairs at Medtronic. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for your time this afternoon. I'm a member of the Minnesota Private College Council Board of Directors and Chair of the Board's Public Policy Committee. By design, the Private College Board includes more business and community leaders than it does college presidents. Composition of the board is a sure sign of the commitment that private college institutions have made to the state to look out not only for their own institutional interests, but also for the interests of the state and the region that they serve. I have to say that for that reason, it's been quite an education serving on the board, because the members and the staff really are dedicated to thinking broadly, to thinking about the future of our entire state, again, not just of their individual interests. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we make this four-point policy recommendation that you see behind me today because our board is convinced that we are approaching a pivotal moment in our state's history. This two-fisted challenge of a more globalized marketplace in which our state's businesses must compete, combined with a rapidly changing state demographic, does in fact threaten our regional economy. Rather than sit back and hope for the best, Minnesota needs to act strategically, and as Dr. Laird's presentation made clear, our state must act to secure a sufficient supply of educated workers for the future, and that future is much closer than many of us might otherwise think. In the higher education budget, the legislature's priorities should be to improve the pipeline of students into higher education, to invest in need-based financial aid, and to ensure the excellence of the University of Minnesota as it pursues a research agenda. Need-based financial aid should be amongst the highest of the state priorities for increased investment this session. Personally, I feel privileged to be employed at a business that has its founding in research done at the University of Minnesota. If you walk around our campus, you would find a number of smart and talented Minnesotans educated at a variety of Minnesota higher education institutions. The overall higher education enterprise of the state has given our business, has given Medtronic and many other businesses a clear home field advantage. But we do have good reason to believe that we may be giving that up soon if our state's overall higher education enterprise cannot meet the challenge before it and keep up with the needs of the state's businesses. We choose to see opportunities and the challenges before us, however, and that choice is reflected in the priorities we bring before you today. Our collective success is at stake, and we hope that the legislature and the governor will look favorably on the recommendations made by our board. And thank you for your time today.
You want to have any questions, Dr. Carlson, Representative Carlson?
No, not a doctor, but
married
to one. Question I have, if I understood your chart on page 13, Dr. Laird, where you've got the footnote there, then $45 million to benefit 80,000 students. My question of both of you, and I'd like you both to respond, because I assume that's the total cost of your request. One response from the higher ed community that you represent or part of it, the other response from the business community. Where would you propose that the $45 million come from? So the budget that's before us, as presented by the governor, essentially doesn't address any of the concerns that you've outlined here. The ESO recommendations, basically, relative to financial aid, child care, if I recall correctly, and our fiscal analyst is here, there weren't any increases in any of those areas, or very minimal if there were. So the $45 million's got to come from somewhere. And I'd like to hear from the business community, being that he just testified and endorsed a $45 million expenditure. I'm on another committee that will deal with that. If you appear there, I might ask you that question. Mr. Esweiler.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, it's the right question to ask. It's a question, obviously, that that all of you have to continue to ask this session. I am going to defer substantially to Dr. Laird on it. I think that the appeal that we are making here is as a business community and as I'm coming forward as a member of Medtronic, part of Medtronic, is an appeal that is based on our overall agenda when we come over to St. Paul's. And that is an appeal that says there are lots of things in balance, as all of you know, that in order to grow biotech and medical tech in Minnesota, we believe strongly that there has to be a balance when it comes to issues like supporting the arts, supporting transportation, supporting education. And we know that it is a difficult and a complicated weave. We know that as our business gets more and more challenged, this is as much a battle of an educated workforce, a competent workforce here, but also coming from around the country and around the world, that keeping that balance in place that Minnesota has always done so well becomes more and more important. So I apologize that I'm not going to give you the direct answer to the direct question that you asked me today, but I will tell you that as we come forward, we recognize that there is a balance in making sure the taxes are appropriate, but also the understanding that the often overused but accurate cliche that this could be a cold and dark place in the Midwest if we didn't do that correctly, in our minds, is a reality every day. We have 6,500 jobs in the state of Minnesota with an average salary in excess of $70,000, and as we expand, and hope to expand going forward here in Minnesota, this is a key reason why we'd like to do this. I should also say that we make significant investments in the state of Minnesota around these issues. We have, for the past 11 years, for example, invested on average over $1 million a year in science and technology programs for our hands-on science programs for K-12 students. We have matching gift programs for our employees that provide a match of up to $7,000 when our employees put money into their local schools or their college alma maters, and a number of other programs that I hope to say to you that this is not only the right thing to do in terms of helping folks move from one economic position to another, but also the right thing to do in terms of supporting the Minnesota business. We have in fact backed our investments behind that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not arguing at all about your goals.
Representative Carlson.
Where the investment, Mr. Chairman,
we're going to get the 45. So I appreciate you saying that it was the right question because it is a very fundamental question to this committee. But I would like to hear then from Dr. Laird, Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Laird.
I was just
going to
say that David's responses were just fine. Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I would ask you to characterize this as a marker with hope and an argument that priorities are going to be even more important than ever. The marker with hope is that the state's economy will continue to improve. And through one form or another, there will be additional resources available to invest in higher education. If not, we will argue that this needs to be a very high priority among the balancing items that you have to contend with in order to find a final balance in the budget. We have made no attempt to suggest places where additional funds ought to be taken in order to support this. We will be faithful participants in the discussion if you want us included. But we do think that our collective future is in the balance in how well we adapt to the demand for additional college graduates for our state's economy and how well we respond to the changing characteristics of our students in high school and college and make sure that we create more successes from them.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm gonna kind of ask the same question, but I'm gonna skin it a little bit differently. Mr. Carlson, would you say that, given this presentation and the proposal submitted, would you say that the current level of investment and or the current nature of investment in higher ed at this point in time won't get the job done in terms of what you're perceiving to be what our challenges will be in the next short year? Is that a safe characterization of both your presentations?
You're addressing the question to Dr. Laird.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, if you assume that everything is on the table for that discussion, yes. If the response to your question is that some things are isolated and that the status quo is just fine, then it's not a fair characterization of our response.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Mariani,
the reason I ask it that way is that I think the challenge before us is clearly, you know, as Representative Carlson indicated, a challenge of, you know, bottom line dollars and where, you know, we're going to both get them from and direct it to. But I think there's also an ongoing challenge for us to do that within a framework of trying to do things differently. And I think that's, to me, one of the compelling issues that one of the compelling characteristics of looking at the demographics of our state, both looking at the nature of the students to come or potentially could come, as well as looking at the massive change that's happening in our workforce tied to our aging population. And I think that, you know, it's only wise for us to, without being threatening to the status quo of higher ed, to simply ask the question whether or not the current way in which we're going about preparing human capital and making it possible for human capital to access higher ed, whether or not we ought to be questioning some of those fundamental ways and perhaps there's wiser ways for us to move people through the pipeline. And I think if we don't at least try to answer that question as well as just answering the question, where's the money going to come from, where's it going to go, then we're only doing half the job here.
Representative Lentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Only to put a finer point on Representative Carlson's comments, although I agree with what Representative Mariani said, the $45 million is the only price tag on one of the four priorities, legislative priorities, that the Private College Council has identified. Each of the other three would also come with an as yet unidentified price tag. We probably could put one on the child care grant because they've got some specific increases in numbers that they're seeking. But expanding the TRIO programs would certainly have a price tag, but not identified, and certainly ensuring excellence, however you wish to define it, at the university would come with a price tag. It's very easy for people to come before any of the committees of this legislature and say, fund us or make us the highest priority. But I think at some point, it shouldn't just be the legislature struggling with the question of how do we fund everything or how do we set our priorities. I think some of that input also has to come from those who come before us and ask for more or set it as a higher priority. Yeah. So I hope this is the beginning of a discussion that does begin to address some of the question, where do the resources come from, and not just put more resources here.
Dr. Laird.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lass, thanks for asking that question. It is indeed a fair question and a reasonable one. I skipped over some of the details to try to save some time here. The price tag on the TRIO recommendation is $10 million for the biennium, and the price tag on the child care is $1.7 million for the biennium. We don't have a way of estimating the university element. And if we are to participate in that discussion, I think we participate as a junior partner, not a very knowledgeable partner, but a supporter of it. we are fully prepared to be a partner in discussions that go to the root of your question. And we not only will do so from the standpoint of the interests of our institutions, but we have tried to characterize our analysis of the future and our recommendations, and we try to shape them to the interests and concerns and the priorities for the future of the state. We're prepared to be full partners in a discussion about that, and I'm very confident that we have other board members like David who are prepared to come to the table and be partners in those discussions as well. If you look at the business community that's represented on our board, it's a pretty broad spectrum of business leaders, and I assure you they fully participated in the preparation of these recommendations and the analysis of the data that underlies it. I think almost every member of our board could give the presentation about our changing demographics and the challenges that we face together. They've seen them and worked with them and massaged them, and they're very concerned about what will occur to us generally if we fail to take measured steps now to prepare for a rapidly changing future.
Mr. Eisweller?
Chairman, Representative Black, just to add on what David is saying, you know, I come today in full recognition that the hard part of this conference from a more difficult job is on the other side of this table, so I don't sound as if I'm avoiding that. I think the business community and those of us on the board of directors, I certainly include myself in this, really have entered into a discussion with the education community, and we're being educated as we go along. And I think what I'm here to hopefully get across to the community is we would like to be part of that conversation. I'm new to this conversation the last couple of years, and you're asking the right question. How do we balance these? How do we balance things out? The one thing I think that we're certain of when we look at the data as a business community is the trends are saying that not enough people are graduating and are going to be graduating from high school in the future. And they're pretty dramatic numbers that we're looking at. If we continue on and assume that we're going to graduate the same number of folks, we're looking at the percentage, we're looking at a 10% decrease in the state of Minnesota. But when you look behind those numbers and you realize that the folks that we really haven't figured out how to serve best yet in our K-12 education system are children of color, that really compounds the equation. So when we look forward to these conversations, we recognize as businesses that we have an issue to deal with. And so I guess what I'm saying here is my role today is not to tell you that I've figured out exactly how it all gets fit together. And what I want to tell you is that our organization is bringing business and educators together, understanding that there's a problem out there, and it's a significant problem that's coming at us faster than we would like to admit, and we would like to have those conversations with you going forward. This is just the beginning, I hope, of that conversation.
Representative Lance.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Laird, Mr. Etzweiler, I do want to also compliment you on the presentation today and stepping forward with these suggestions. In particular, I seem to recall my reaction to Dr. Laird's presentation when I was first on this committee 2 years ago, and how much I appreciate the analysis of the demographics of higher education as well, and what you're projecting. I also seem to recall, and the record will be better in memory than I am on this, but some of these same issues in terms of the future of higher education in Minnesota were raised a couple of years ago, some of the same concerns. And I'm hopeful that we can do a better job of addressing these this session than in my own perception we did last session. Because I don't want you coming back in 2 years again and saying we've got a new session and we still have these issues and we're still not even taking baby steps in the right direction to address these. So thank you for your presentations.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I raised that question. You know, I think everyone that's on this committee is here by choice, and are interested in higher education, and we are advocates of higher education. We have pretty intense debates sometimes on how to divide the pie between what goes into HESO and what goes into the two systems, and even to a minor degree, Mayo Medical is one of our accounts as well, but it's not one of the big ones. But we've had a shrinking pie. You know, last biennium was $380 million that was cut out of the higher education pie. It took the highest or hardest hit, I think, in all of state government. And I've heard others comment, and I'm sure other committee members have, that maybe even in the entire country, in terms of the reductions, relatively speaking, in higher education. And so that's why I turn first to the business community, because I think we've got a real issue here in terms of how we choose to invest. And when I ask about the $45 million, and Representative Latz appropriately said there are other issues in addition to that one chart that I was alluding to, but it becomes an important question, and I would hope that it's one that the business community, that's why I asked you first, and I'm glad to hear you are communicating with the education community, and hopefully come forward with some recommendations in terms of the resource question. And I do have to say that I know you're here on behalf of the private sector here today, but there's been immense change in the public sector. We had a regent here the other day that commented that during his tenure, I think he's single term now, reelected, maybe 7 years on the Board of Regents, but 81% tuition increase at the University of Minnesota. Research was impacted, and then I would compliment the private colleges for having as one of their recommendations a recognition that the important role that research plays in the future of the state of Minnesota. But our fundamental problem in this committee is, as we move forward this biennium, and it was last biennium, is that we simply have not been given the resources to invest that's really needed in higher education. And I'd probably give the same speech, and not currently, but at one time I was also on the K-12 funding committee, and there's some tremendous needs there that play into a lot of the demographics that you're talking about here in terms of the pipeline, how we reach the K-12 students and the changing demographics there to increase the graduation rates and therefore the college participation rates. So we really have issues before us in terms of investment preschool, literally all the way through graduate education. And I would be interested in a little more precise answer in the future from the business community in particular on how you want to see investments met, because we are talking about a resource question, bottom line, and you avoided and I avoided using the word that everybody knows that's really being talked about here. Thank you.
I don't know if there's any other questions. I think one of the key things is the February forecast, which we're really hoping to be a positive one, and that'll help, I think, address some of the things we're talking about here today without avoiding some of those other terms, or with avoiding those terms. Any other questions? Seeing none, I would like to thank Dr. Laird for being here today and her testimony, and also Mr. Etzweiler, is it? Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you,
and
Mr. Chairman.
We will now ask for a motion to approve the minutes from the meeting of the 31st.
So moved.
Representative Dempsey moves the minutes of Monday, January 31st. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes approved, and the meeting is adjourned.